Welcome to Practical Christian Living.
He said, I am the door. Anyone who enters in any other way is a thief and a liar, but anyone who comes in through the door will have eternal life. Jesus has directly said, I am the Messiah, to the woman at the well, to the blind man. He even told them, before Abraham was, I am.
We hope your faith has been examined and strengthened by our special series through the book of John, I Believe, as we look at the very foundations of the Christian faith, why we believe what we believe, and why so many in the days of Jesus found it so difficult to believe that they were witnessing the Messiah. Today we're in John 10, verses 22 through 42. Stay with us. Here comes Robert Furrow, pastor of Calvary, Tucson.
Verses 22 in chapter 10 through 42 in chapter 10 really emphasize the miracles, or what Jesus is going to call his works. Think about the miracles that Jesus did. Think about what they were like and what they would say about him. That's the point that he's going to end up making about this. And it takes place around the Feast of Dedication. Now, this is interesting. If you study John from chapter 5 through chapter 10, that section of the book of John is called the section of the feasts. Almost everything that happens in those chapters, those five chapters, centers around the different feasts that happen in Jerusalem. Some of the events are in the Galilee, but we're told the feast of Passover was near. We're told that that time was near. It all centers around the feasts. Now, the feast, it's an interesting study. If you go back into the book of Leviticus and you study the seven different feasts, there were seven mandatory feasts every year. Wouldn't that be good, by the way? You and I have what? Probably a handful of mandatory feasts. We've got the Thanksgiving feast. We've got a Christmas feast, right? But they had seven of them. There was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles. And each of those feasts, it's interesting to go into a study of all seven of them. Seven's the number of completeness. And when you study the feast, they all speak so clearly of Jesus. It's a powerful study. It's one of the reasons a study in the book of Leviticus can be so good. You think, Leviticus? And when you get into it, there's some really incredible, powerful things that are there. So verse 22 starts off saying this. Verse 22 of John chapter 10. Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem. Now here's the interesting thing about the Feast of Dedication. It's not a biblical feast. It's not one of the seven mandatory feasts. It's like for the Jews, seven weren't enough. Let's keep adding them. But it is a historical feast. It's looking back at a miracle that happened in Israel. That is significant because on this Feast of Dedication, which remembers a miracle, Jesus is going to be talking about the miracles that he did. Now, I want to get historical with you for a moment. And this is what happens when you get historic. You start talking about history, here's what happens to people's faces. They glass over. So I just want you to know, this is a short section, and it's really good to know this information, all right? And I'm going to go all the way back to Alexander the Great. This is in explaining what the Feast of Dedication is, all right? But I want to start with Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great conquered the world by the time he was 30. He conquered the entire known world. It said that Alexander the Great wept because there was no more world to conquer. He died around 30 years old, and he didn't have a succession plan because he was 30. And so they divided his kingdom among his four generals. Two of the generals' names was Seleucus and Ptolemy. Those are the two that are important to us. There are other two, and here's what happened, and it was almost predictable. You're going to divide a kingdom into fours. Within two or three generations, what would they be doing? Fighting against each other. And that's exactly what happened. The Greek Empire might well have been able to withstand the Roman Empire, but they were divided against themselves. They were fighting against each other. So when the new kid on the block, the Roman Empire, showed up, they were able to dominate the world and to conquer each one of these four different areas. In the Seleucid Empire, which is the modern-day Turkey, all around, all the way down to Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, was in the Ptolemy quarter. The Ptolemy was northern Africa. Have I lost you guys already? The Ptolemy dynasty was northern Africa and Egypt, and they were fighting against each other. And the eighth emperor in the Seleucus dynasty was a man you may have heard of before. He was kind of the Hitler of his day, and that is a guy by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. The name Epiphanes means strong as God or strong like God. And that's a name he gave himself. You know, when emperors name themselves, they named themselves. Augustus just called himself God. Caesar Augustus. Caesar, God. He said, enough of this strong like God stuff. I just am God. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes called himself Epiphanes, strong like God, but the people around him called him Epimenes, which was kind of a play on words, and Epimenes means madman. So he wanted to be called, you know, Antiochus Epiphanes, but the people called him Antiochus Epimenes because he was a little crazy. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes was fighting against the Ptolemy dynasty, and he went down to Egypt with his army. A large army. This is an emperor of his own little dynasty, okay? And he goes down to fight against the Ptolemy dynasty, and on the way, he runs into the new kid on the block, a Roman general who has his army with him. And he brings a message from the Senate, from the Roman Senate, and he tells Antiochus, stop attacking Egypt. They have made a treaty with the Ptolemy dynasty, and so they tell him, we're meeting you here. Stop attacking them. This is a message from the Senate. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes was a proud man, no shock. And so he said, I'll give you my answer on some other day. And so the general pulled out a sword and drew a circle in the dirt around Antiochus and said, if you step out of this circle before you give us this answer, we will consider that to be war. And you will be fighting not only against the Ptolemies, but you will be fighting against the Roman Empire. And so Antiochus was a practical man to some degree. He realized, I can't defeat the Roman army, probably not even the one that he was facing there. And so he turned away in anger and shame. Now, at the same time, there was a civil war going on in Israel. We're talking about 175 BC. There's a civil war going on in Israel, and it was over the Hellenistic Jews and the more Hebrew or Jewish Jews. We might call them the more conservative Jews. The Hellenistic Jews were wanting to Hellenize or make Jerusalem more like a Greek city. They had even built a gymnasium there. And if you know anything about the Greek gymnasiums, a lot of immorality came with the gymnasiums. And so there was a gymnasium that was built there, and there was a civil war taking place. And Antiochus Epiphanes, have I lost you yet, by the way? And we're coming to the Feast of the Dedication, okay, to what the Feast of Dedication is. So Antiochus Epiphanes decided he was going to go and attack Jerusalem to stop this civil war, fighting on the side of the Hellenists. And so he marched in, and he gave a command to his army to kill every man, woman, and child that he saw in the streets. Remember Antiochus Epiphanes, madman. And he killed 80,000 men, women, and children. Literally, as I said, struck them down on the streets as they marched into Jerusalem. He captured another 80,000 and enslaved them. Murdered 80,000, enslaved 80,000. When he got to Jerusalem, he slaughtered a pig on the altar. Remember, the altar is that giant grill that sat outside the temple at which they would sacrifice animals on to God. To slaughter a pig on the altar would desecrate it, and the Jews would no longer use it. He turned the temple itself into a house of prostitution, and he built a statue of Zeus over the altar and turned it into a place of worship. For several years, the Jews wouldn't go near the temple because it had literally been desecrated. It was partially a fulfillment. We also know the Antichrist will fulfill it, of what Daniel called the abomination of desolation. It was an abomination that caused desolation because the Jews wouldn't go to their temple, and that's exactly what Epiphanes wanted, was for them to feel that they were under control of the Greeks. Now, Epiphanes got bored in Jerusalem. He went off to go fight another battle, and he left an army there in Israel. And a priest came to power and began to rally the troops behind him. This priest's name was Maccabees. There were the Maccabees brothers, and the Maccabees set off in guerrilla warfare against Epiphanes' army, which was organized and strong, but couldn't withstand the guerrilla warfare. And how often has that been the case throughout history? and they were defeated by the Maccabees. The Maccabees went in and they rededicated the temple. This is the Feast of Dedication. The Maccabees went back in and they dedicated the temple. They dedicated the altar. And Antiochus Epiphanes heard that his army had been defeated, garnered his army and was heading back to Jerusalem, died the next day. His army abandoned it. They didn't go. They just decided they were on their way. But after Epiphanes died, they abandoned it. And God once again gave control of the temple area back to Israel, back to the leadership that was in Israel. They would fall under Roman control soon after that, but up to that point, it was under their own control. So after they dedicated the temple, after they cleansed and dedicated the altar, they wanted to relight the candelabra known as the menorah. It was in the temple itself, and it was to always remain lit. It was to never go out. It had obviously been out under the terrors of Epiphanes. But they only found one cruse of dedicated oil. The law had said that the priests had to make and mix and consecrate a special kind of an oil. It would take 8 days for them to prepare it. They only found one. And so they lit the menorah for that one, and miraculously, this is the miracle, it lasted for 8 days until the oil that the priests were making was ready to be dedicated to them. And so you know the Feast of Dedication, even though it's not in the Bible, because it is what? Hanukkah. It was in late November and early December. By the way, those of you who are smiling knowingly, like I told you so, good for you. You had to figure it out. But it's the reason that they go through the lighting of Hanukkah. And now we'll have a better understanding as to what it's about. But when they gathered together in the Feast of Dedications, and today when they celebrate Hanukkah, they're celebrating a miracle. And what was that miracle saying to them? The fact that that lamp burned for 8 days when it should have only have burnt for one told them what? That God was with them. That even though they had survived the horrors of Antiochus Epiphanes, and these were horrors, I'm telling you, children, women struck down in the streets by these armies. It was a horrible time for the nation of Israel. Even though they had gone through those horrors, God was still with them. That miracle said something. So it doesn't shock us on the day that they are celebrating a miracle that Jesus talks about his own miracles. That just as that miracle was significant and said something, the miracles of Jesus are significant and they mean something. So let's pick it up in verse 22 of chapter 10 of the book of John. It says, "Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem." That could just as well read, "It was the Feast of Hanukkah in Jerusalem. And it was winter." The term for winter there, well, we know Hanukkah falls in late November and late December, so we know it's winter time. But the term there, "it was winter," literally is, "and it was stormy," or "it was cold." The weather was bad. "And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch." Solomon's porch was an area in the temple that was the only remaining section of what Solomon had built. They were porches in between the Valley of Kidron and the temple itself that could protect you from the weather. And so Jesus is walking in Solomon's porch. He's made the trip to Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication. "Then the Jews surrounded him." Now, John uses the term Jews to speak of the leadership of Israel. These would be scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, men from the Sanhedrin. Do you remember who the Sanhedrin was? These are 70 Jews that are judges over Israel. They have been stripped of most of their power at this point by the Romans, which is why they bring Jesus to the Romans to be able to be condemned and crucified. But these would be men from the Sanhedrin. They would be judges. That's significant in a little while. "Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, 'How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly.'" Now, they act like they just want to know. How long are you going to keep us in doubt? We just want to know, are you the Messiah? Tell us plainly if you're the Christ. But here's the thing. Jesus has told them again and again and again. He has made grand statements like, "I am the light of the world." If anyone comes to me, he will never die, and he will live in light and will never walk in darkness. He said, I am the door. Anyone who enters in any other way is a thief and a liar, but anyone who comes in through the door will have eternal life. Jesus has directly said, I am the Messiah, to the woman at the well, to the blind man. He even told them before Abraham was, I am. So now when they stand there and go, tell us, they surround him, first of all, tell us whether or not you're the Messiah, we need to know. Jesus knows what they're doing. They're there to try to provoke him so that they can kill him. That's what they want to do. This is them approaching Jesus. Now, his time isn't yet. They're going to kill him within 3 months, but they're not going to be able to kill him here and now. And so they say to Jesus, tell us plainly, are you the Christ? Okay, that's the end of verse 24. And then in 25, Jesus answered them, I told you and you did not believe. Now that's an important statement for our text. I told you and you did not believe. He's already had this conversation with them. If you remember back to a study we had, I don't know what, a couple of months ago, where Jesus said, if I tell you I am the Christ, my testimony means nothing. What Jesus is saying is anybody can say anything about themselves and it doesn't make it true. I could tell you that I am a pink elephant. Doesn't make it true. There are witnesses that make a fact true. And then Jesus had said, I have another who testifies of me, and that is my Father. And remember, we talked about the Old Testament prophecies that God had put in place about the Messiah and that God had testified of Jesus being the Messiah. Jesus was saying, don't believe me because I tell you I'm the Messiah, but believe what my Father has shown you in the Scriptures. That we have things foretold is amazing. Now Jesus goes to another witness. He says, God the Father is a witness. He says, I told you, and you already didn't believe, which helps us to understand these guys have already made a decision. They don't believe. There are people that weigh the evidence of Jesus being the Messiah and don't believe. There are people who don't weigh the evidence at all and simply choose not to believe. As Christians, some of us were touched by God and we believed without considering any evidence. Others here looked at the evidence. You were challenged, you were encouraged, and you looked at it and you saw it and you believed. They have chosen not to believe. And so Jesus says, I told you and you did not believe. Then he says this, the works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. You're asking me to be a witness of myself and tell you whether or not I'm the Christ? The works that I do, they bear witness of me. So what do the works that Jesus did tell us about him? First of all, what were his works? Jesus did 40, over 40, recorded miracles. It started with the very first miracle of turning water into wine. From there, he went and he healed Peter's mother-in-law. From there, he ran into a Roman soldier whose servant was sick, and he healed that servant. Early on, he ran into a man that had leprosy. The law had told them that you don't touch a leper. I don't know that the law has to tell you not to touch a leper, by the way. In those days, if you saw a leper, it wasn't the first thought that you had to run up and go, oh, let me touch that leper. I think that when you saw a leper, you were like, I got to get away from this leper as far away as I can possibly go. But the Bible says after Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, that he walked down that mountain and there was a leper there that met him. And the leper fell down on the ground and worshiped him. And that Jesus went up and touched that leper and instantly he was made clean. What kind of a man touches lepers and cleanses them? What type of a man sees blind people and cleanses them? And another time, Jesus ran into 10 lepers and cleansed all 10 of them. What kind of a man cleanses lepers? What kind of a man heals people that have been lame for decades? What kind of a man straightens out a man with a withered hand? What do these works tell you about the one who is doing them? What kind of a man walks on water? Another one of his works. What kind of a man can control the wind and the waves when he stood up on the front of that boat and said, cease and be still? See, all of these things tell us of a loving, kind, powerful, compassionate man. And what's more, even more powerful about the miracles that Jesus is doing is that in the Old Testament, in all of the Old Testament, think about all of the plagues, the wonders, the miraculous in the Old Testament. In all of the Old Testament, there's only two healings. There's judgments that were reversed, like Miriam that was given leprosy and then it was taken away from her. But if we take those judgments out of it, there's only two healings. One of them was an Assyrian general by the name of Naaman who was healed of leprosy. The other of them was King Hezekiah, who turned his face to the wall after being told that he was going to die of a disease, called out to God, and God healed him. Out of all of the history of the Old Testament, only two healings. And then Jesus comes on the scene, and there is an explosion of them. It was as if God was saying, something powerful, something significant is taking place right now. And I'll suggest to you as well that since Jesus, there has been no one who can do the works that he's done. Jesus came on the scene, and these works were so incredible and so powerful that the world received him as the Messiah. He was in a little out-of-the-way place called Palestine. The whole world received the message of the gospel, and the church spread around the world within 30 years of him. Now, a couple of years ago, I did a study on the Messiah, of Jesus being the Messiah, and I had made this statement during that study. Who else in all of history, and think about all of history and the great men that you know in history, who else in all of history could qualify to be the Messiah? My point was that there would not be one other person in all of history who would qualify to be the Messiah that showed the kind of compassion, the kind of love, the kind of works that he did. Afterwards, a gal came up to me, it was a Saturday night service. Afterwards, a gal came up to me and she said, Gandhi. Gandhi qualified to be the Messiah. And I told her, I don't want to be a Gandhi hater. Because, I mean, it's Gandhi, right? And Gandhi's kind of lifted up in our culture. But just go look up the Gandhi Wikipedia. And just read about his life. And you're going to see that Gandhi did some horrible things. The works of Gandhi disqualify him from being the Messiah, because they were not good works. Again, I'm not being a Gandhi hater. It's just the truth. Just go back and look at it. Just study his life. We don't want to rewrite history, right? We want things to be right and we want things to be true. And so the works of Jesus, here Jesus is at a feast that they're celebrating a miracle, which was a sign to them that God was still with them. And Jesus says to them, my works bear witness of me. If they weren't going to believe Jesus because he said he was the Messiah, and maybe they shouldn't. Again, just because somebody says something, there needs to be more proof than that. Jesus could have said every day, 10 times a day, I'm the Messiah, I'm the Messiah, I'm the Messiah, and it wouldn't have meant anything because it was him testifying to himself. But there are other witnesses, the Old Testament, the prophecies, the Father giving the Word of God, and now the works that he did that help us to understand the kind of person that he is. And so Jesus says, my works, they bear witness of me. Then verse 26, but you do not believe. He already knows. They have made the decision. They're part of the Sanhedrin, the judges of Israel, and they've made a decision not to believe no matter what. It's a pretense. Tell us plainly, if you are the Messiah, like they're really interested. Jesus says, you guys have already determined that you don't believe because you are not my sheep.
Thank you for joining us for Practical Christian Living with Robert Furrow. We hope that our verse-by-verse studies truly help you to see that God is real. He wants a personal relationship with you, and His Word is life-changing. If you'd like to hear more of Robert Furrow's teachings, visit calvarytucson.com. For our local listeners, we invite you to join us at one of our two campuses. Our East Campus at Speedway and Camino Seco meets Saturdays at 6 p.m. and Sundays at 9:45 a.m. Our West Campus, south of Palo Verde and I-10, meets Sunday mornings at 8:30 and 11 a.m. Our midweek service times are Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. at our East Campus and 7:15 p.m. at our West Campus. If you prefer, you can watch our service at live.calvarytucson.com and also on our Facebook page and YouTube channel. Our online campus is available during East Campus service times. If Practical Christian Living has blessed you and you'd like to donate, please visit pclaz.org. That's pclaz.org, where you can make a secure one-time donation or sign on to become a monthly partner on a reoccurring basis. Have you accepted Jesus into your life, or do you have questions about salvation? We'd love to hear from you. Email us at saved@calvarytucson.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media, Instagram at Calvary Tucson or Facebook at Calvary Chapel Tucson. We want to remind our local listeners that you can watch Practical Christian Living TV Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. on KGUN 9. Thank you for joining us for Practical Christian Living.
Christian, you are called by God to influence our culture for Christ. The 2023 Defending the Faith Conference is happening March 6th through 8th in Tucson, Arizona. Learn from Skip Heitzig and David Guzik. The world's top expert on the resurrection, Gary Habermas, will share teachings that are biblical and highly practical. You will be equipped to answer the hardest questions Christians face. Register today to attend Defending the Faith, the 2023 Southwest Pastors and Leaders Conference, March 6th through 8th in Tucson, Arizona. Learn more and register at calvarytucson.com/conference. That's calvarytucson.com.